turn to Genesis 29 today, and I want to talk about something I wanted to talk about for a couple of months, I guess. Have you ever heard someone say something against you, perhaps behind your back? Have you ever been mistreated or abused by somebody? Have you experienced these kinds of things? Have you ever been shunned? Of course, that's happened to many of us as we've been forced to leave different congregations. But have you experienced some kind of rejection in your life? Because I say probably every single one of us has experienced some form of this, and we have lived with a certain level of rejection in our lives. And this fear can be one of the most powerful forces in our lives. In fact, I think to one degree or another, Americans might be what you might call obsessed by this when you look at some of our TV shows. For example, the American Idol, and they have another one about bachelors that I've read about. I've watched American Idol and so on. And the music's entertaining. I'm sure the program is interesting and so on. But you know how the news always saves the important, interesting articles for the last? Well, so do these programs. And you know what to them is the most interesting part? Is the rejection of those who didn't make it and their reaction to the failure to make it. And they focus in on this and they look at it. And so it's like Americans like this. It's like they somehow enjoy the rejection when they can view it safely from their comfort or their home on their television sense. But when we experience it personally, then it's a different story. We dread it. And sometimes we live in fear of this, and we allow it to influence our lives to a large degree. When we feel this sense of rejection from other people, it makes our stomach turn, doesn't it? It gives us feelings and emotions and thoughts that we didn't think possible. We think and say and we do things that we would never normally think or say or ordinarily do. And this takes place because we feel like we've been somehow trashed, so we've been somehow deemed worthless by other human beings. And there is within this a certain element of fear that's connected with this. And fear can paralyze us. It tortures us emotionally. It can destroy the confidence that we need to have success in our lives. And emotions like this, they are enormously powerful. Enormously. I remember this story of men, or four of them, in a Jeep. And it was during the Vietnam War. And they were going down, they were riding this Jeep down this path, and all of a sudden they experienced fire coming, incoming, and it seemed to be coming from almost every direction. Instead of throwing it in reverse, the driver of the Jeep tried to turn it around, but the path was too small and the shoulder too soft, and the Jeep began to sink down in the soft dirt and mud that was there. And the men were ordered by the one driving, jump out of the Jeep, jump out, and grab the corners and lift this Jeep out of its ditch, lift it out of the rut and set it back. And they did, and in about 5 seconds, these men grabbed that Jeep and they turned that thing around and got it out of the rut. They hopped back in and they drove it out of harm's way. And when they got back to the base, they told everyone about what had happened to them and how they had escaped. And everyone laughed at them and said, you can't do that. And they said, sure we can. Watch this. And the four men grabbed a hold of that Jeep and they couldn't move it an inch. You understand my point? Emotions have this powerful, powerful effect on us. And they can make us do amazing things. And they sometimes can help us greatly, and other times hurt us greatly. Dr. Walter Cannon is a researcher in psychosomatic medicine, works for Harvard University, and he describes what happens to us when these kinds of emotions take control. And he says that our respiration begins to deepen, the heart beats, of course, much more rapidly, and the arterial blood pressure expands greatly in our bodies. Our blood supply shifts from the stomach and the intestines to the heart and the central nervous system and all of our powerful muscles. and the processes of the alimentary canal cease, sugar is freed from reserves in the liver, the spleen actually contracts and discharges a concentration of corpuscles, and the adrenaline is released into our system. And our whole body is prepared then to flee or to fight. That is the power that emotions control over us. And like I said, it can save us in extreme conditions, but it can also work to hurt us if we don't control it. This is the power it has over us. It can paralyze us, our emotions can. And the fear of rejection can be just as paralyzing as any other, and it can freeze us into inaction at certain times in our lives when we need to make decisions and moves. You know, there's a sort of science fiction comedy that I remember. Remember the movie Back to the Future? It was interesting. Marty McFly goes back to the time of the year 1955, and he goes back there to make sure that his mother marries his father so that he'll be born. And in this scene, there's a time when he tries to get his dad to date his mother. And his father says to him, "You mean on a date?" "Well, I don't know about that, Marty," he says. "I don't know about that. I mean, what if she says no? What if she laughs at me? I don't think I can take that kind of rejection," he says to his son. And then he says, "Do you know what I mean?" And Marty looks down and he says, "Yes, I know what you mean." In fact, when his dad says this, we all know what he means, don't we? No one likes to be rejected. No one likes to feel the hurt that it makes you feel. No one wants to feel like we're not good enough. There's something wrong with us. In the book Unfinished Business, David Simmons tells this story. He was a former cornerback for the Dallas Cowboys, and he tells in this book the story of his personal childhood. His father was a military man, and he was extremely demanding. Hardly said a kind word to him as a youth, and he would push his son to do better and better and better, but he'd do it with harsh words and criticism all the time. And I'm sure his father thought he was doing the best for him, but you understand, he never let him feel any satisfaction from his accomplishments. There was always something new to do, something else to conquer, some other thing that he had to do. He tells a story in there of his father bringing home a bicycle that was disassembled, and he told his son to assemble the bicycle, commanded him to put it together, and after this young boy then struggled to do it and brought himself to the point of tears, and he couldn't do it. And so his father took it back from him, and he said, "I knew you couldn't do it," and so he assembled it himself. Do you understand how this works on a person over time? Later, his son would play football in high school, and when he'd get home, his father would go over every single error he made in the game. He'd watch it carefully and go over every single one, point out every single one of them. As an adult, someone said this, "You know, other boys, they got butterflies in their stomach because they had to play the game. I got butterflies in my stomach when I had to go home and face my father." It was more stressful for him than to fight and work to battle the opposing team. When it was time to go to college, he chose the University of Georgia, and the reason he said he chose it was because it was the furthest place away from his home. He wanted to get away from his father's criticism. He came to hate that father's criticism with all of his heart, he said, and after college, he actually was picked for the second draft of the St. Louis Cardinals, which was a professional football team. And excited about this, he called home to tell his father. It was Joe Namath who was the club's first pick, but he did not pick them. He went somewhere else. But he was picked as his second, and he was so excited he called home to tell his dad, and his father answered him and said, "Well, how does it feel to be second?" So if you've ever felt rejected, welcome to the club. We've almost all felt it at one time or another, I think, in our lives. Many of the greatest people who ever lived had to deal with enormous amounts of criticism and critical rejection in their lives. It's something so many have gone through. And today, society to me has devised myriad ways for us to realize we have to do this or that or the other thing to measure up. I mean, from kindergarten it starts out, we begin our training on how to be accepted by the clothes we wear, how strong we are, how cute we are, you know, how well we do our ABCs and all that kind of thing, where we get initiated early on. And so our acceptance comes to be how we dress in life, our clothing, the car we drive, the kind of job we have, or where we live, or the kind of house we have where we live. The location is sometimes so important, and how we look and address, and dress is so important. And I remember, in fact, the things that we do to be accepted are so important in some people's minds. I remember a minister who once kicked out an elderly couple because they didn't feel capable of driving the distance to attend where the leading evangelist was speaking. And so he felt that was a sign of disloyalty, and he kicked them out of the church. And 1 or 2 years later, he himself left the church. But you understand my point. We're so quick to judge people, and so quick to condemn people, so quick to put people down. And it is so painful to feel that kind of rejection. And so when you and I felt that as youths, we often said to ourselves, we won't let it affect us like that again. All of us have experienced it. A boyfriend who let us go, a girlfriend who let us go, a husband or wife who did it, who divorced us, parents telling us you'll never amount to anything. We've had bosses who didn't want us anymore. We didn't think our services were valuable in sports. We didn't make the team. And there were people, I remember, who went to Ambassador College, and they went there with a desperate hope that they would be able to be hired and they'd be able to be a part of God's work, and yet they didn't make it. They weren't accepted at the time. And it just ate at them inside to have given their life and not made it and to have felt that kind of rejection. And so at work, the committee rejects your project. The person you thought to be your friend turns out to be someone who betrays you. The Bible, it's just filled with stories like this. And we read of them. But when we read of these stories of others who have suffered rejection, do we identify with them or do we just read over them? Do we feel any of the feelings that they may have felt? Because today I want us to think about this, and I want us to think about them, and I want us to identify with them, and I want to do it for a very important reason we'll discuss later on. Today's world is a unique one, to say the least. They've done studies, of course, on just about everything, and one of the studies they did was about women, and they asked women, would you rather be smart or would you rather be pretty? What do you think the answer was? The answer was the overwhelming majority wanted to be pretty. Because in our society, it buys you more. It buys you more in our society. But not everyone is pretty. And ironically, some that are not as pretty are the more beautiful. Genesis 29, verse 16. Now Laban had two daughters, and the name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. She had a good shape. She was hot. Hot chick. You understand what's going on here? In other words, she wasn't as good looking as Leah was. Now it would be hard enough growing up with a sister who is not as good looking as you. But then her father marries her to Jacob unknowingly, and then, you know, he doesn't love her. And I just agonize when I read that story, when I think of the account. Because in our today's world, everyone's expected to be pretty. Everyone's expected to be beautiful, you know. And so they set this artificial standard in the movies and in the media and in the magazines of what a woman's supposed to be. And there's one example where Michelle Pfeiffer is on the front page of the cover of a magazine, and the magazine headline is, What Michelle Pfeiffer Needs. Then there's her picture, and at the bottom it says, Absolutely Nothing. You know, it's not true. She's just no different than the rest of us. Proverbs 31. She needs absolutely nothing, the article claimed. But of course she's no different than the rest of us. The reporter, a different reporter, happened to find the individual, did the research, and found the individual who did the touch-up for the cover story, and he actually gave the reporter the breakdown of the work that he did. Clean up complexion, soften eye line, soften smile line, add color to the lips, trim the chin and remove the necklines, which you ought to be able to do for me on TV. Would you do that for me, Terry? Clean up so I look about 20 years younger. Add blush to the cheek, clean the neckline, remove the stray hair and the hair strands on the dress, adjust color, add hair on top of head, soften neck muscles a bit, clean up and smoothen dress folds, cost $1,500. You understand? But you understand my point in this, is that women aren't just subject to having to look like movie stars. They're being subject to being expected to look and compare themselves to movie stars that have been retouched and made to look better than they are. It's an impossible world to live in. And all this pressure is on people all the time. And so it says in Proverbs 31, and verse 30, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. I still remember a lady I used to visit in a convalescent home. There was a period during the liberal era where it was a younger evangelist was in charge while Mr. Armstrong would fly around. He told us, you know, people was liberal and people stopped serving in the church. And so we were told by him, go out and serve in the community. So I began to go out and serve in the community, and I would visit convalescent homes and so on like that. So I met Mabel there, and she was a lady who, as a young woman, her husband disliked her and put her down and hated her. And she finally, at one point, decided she would take her life, and she took a gun and pointed it at her head and pulled the trigger. And unfortunately, she didn't die. She survived but was blinded, and she lived with terrible pain all of her life that she still lived. And she told me, though, that she had found the truth and that Jesus was a Savior and that he would never leave her and never forsake her. And so as much as she suffered and as disfigured as her head and face was from this gunshot wound, imagine how beautiful she was to Christ, because she believed in him and she trusted in him. And so there was a beauty there. And I think every one of us has to come to this place. We've got to realize that not everyone is going to appreciate who you are. Not everybody is going to appreciate what you're able to do. And we can't stop being what we were created to be because of other people's opinions of us. We can't spend the rest of our lives cowering in some kind of fear because they don't believe in who we are. We need to stop trying to be what other people want us to be. And we need to start being what Jesus Christ wants us to be. Let's go to Matthew 16, if you will. You know, some of us are still driven by this huge thing of popularity, and we care very much about what others think of us. We think, what if I don't do what they expect me to do? What if I don't reach their expectations? What if they reject me? What if I fail? What if things don't work out? And this is one of the reasons many are actually crippled by this fear. They care more about what people think about them than what God thinks about them. And we've got to get over this. It's a part of our age. It's a big part of the media. It's a big part of the way things are expressed to us and the way information is traveled around. What is it that really matters? I'm not going to let some critic who thinks we should live by his or her definition of what normalcy is discourage us from being who we are and what we're called to be. And let it, like it says in the Bible, let God be true, but every man a liar. And this is the way, only way I think we can overcome this fear of rejection that each one of us has experienced to one degree or another in our lives. And so I think this is part of what is being said here by Jesus Christ in Matthew 16. Each one of us in our own way must start living our lives according to an audience of one, the one. And so he says in 16 and verse 24, Jesus said to his disciples, and he says to you, and he says to me today, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. So we don't have to follow what everybody else is saying. And we need to realize that. We don't need to be affected by their evaluation. I mean, let's put it in some sort of perspective for a minute. You know, it doesn't mean that we should never listen to other people's advice. I mean, in a multitude of counsel, their safety, that's valuable. When they genuinely care about you and have your interests at heart. My point today is we've got to recognize that there's a difference, and there is a difference in those who will voluntarily advise you negatively about your value and who you are and what your work is and what you're doing into your life. 2 Timothy, if we will. 2 Timothy. You understand my point. Jesus Christ cares more about us than our parents. He cares more about us than our friends. He cares more about us than our brothers and sisters. He cares more about us than our mate. He is someone who cares more about us than anybody else in the world does. And it's only he that I believe can be counted on to never leave us or forsake us. Do you remember when he was traveling through Samaria and he spoke to a woman at the well, and that she was a woman who was pretty much rejected by the community in which she lived? She had been married 5 times, and she was now living with a man. Why so many men? What was she searching for? Do you understand my point? What was she looking for? Jesus came and showed her he was the one that had the living waters. He was the one she was looking for. He was the one who could fulfill her needs. She could go from man to man to man to man, and that's what people are doing in our society today, aren't they? Looking for something, looking for acceptance, looking for love for who I am. Going to person to person to person to person. And if you do this good thing for them, it's generally not enough. They want you to do more and more and more and then jump higher and higher. You understand? It's kind of like that. That's how human nature is. It's never satisfied, so you're never going to be able to completely please someone anyway. Kind of what's happening today, and I believe in our world. What's the problem that can develop is some people don't bounce back from rejection very easily. They begin to develop a phobia sometimes about themselves, and they think the problem is with them, and eventually they begin to think everybody else sees the problem I have, and so they begin to avoid other people, and they kind of become reclusive and avoiding others, and they get trapped in a phobia, trapped in the fear of rejection, and that's where it really begins to hurt them. They begin to feel hopeless and that no good can ever come, and so they begin to make decisions based on these fears, based on these emotions, instead of decisions based on faith and belief in God, like we should. And that's why it says here in 2 Timothy 1:7, God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. 1 Corinthians 4. So we need to remember, I believe, that we don't even have the ability to measure ourselves. In other words, it's an irony that is, in one sense, if you begin to see this, it's an irony that's almost shocking. In other words, look, we care about what Sally or Sam or Jim or Joe thinks about us, and they're judging us, but we don't have the power to even judge ourselves. We can't even do that properly. And so 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 3 says this, with me it's a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by a human court. In fact, I don't even judge myself, for I know nothing against myself, yet I'm not justified by this, but by he who judges me is the Lord. Therefore, judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the heart, and then each one's praise will come from God. Now these things, brethren, I've said figuratively and transferred to myself and Apollos for your sakes. You may learn in us not to think beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up on behalf of one against the other. Well, we shouldn't even be judging ourselves. We should be doing the best we can for Christ and then let him be the judge. Certainly never other people, not even ourselves. So if we can kind of put this in perspective, we begin to see how small it is that we are judged by others. And humanly, I think that our values are off. I remember Dennis always says we don't have the moral compass within us to make the right kind of judgments. And there's a kind of silly story that I think reminds me of the principle. A lady went to a butcher, and she wanted to buy a chicken for her family for dinner that night. And she went to the butcher, and he brought out a chicken from the back room, and he put it in the scale and weighed it, and she thought, that's probably not big enough. She said, I'd like to have a little bigger one, please. Well, he only had one chicken, so he takes that chicken back to the back room, and he comes back, and he puts it on the scale, but this time he kind of lets his thumb rest on the scale a little bit to make it look like it's a little heavier. And the lady's thinking, she says, that's probably still a little too small. I think I'll take both chickens. It's silly, isn't it? But you understand my point. Human judgment can't be trusted, can it? It's very off track. It's very stilted. And so we can't trust the way that a man or a woman judges or measures us or the values that we have. And so what others think of us is not generally that important. Come back to Genesis 29. What a human court judges of us is not that important. What I think of myself is not important. It's what God thinks of us that is really what's important. And he says this, I'll never reject you if you don't reject me. He's the one we can trust. But I want to go back here, and I want you to think for a minute, what do you think Leah felt like? What was it like for her? How difficult would that have been? Because it's not easy. Every one of us, we can talk and say, well, we shouldn't let them judge us, and we shouldn't. But the point I make is that it hurts. It hurts anyway. There's no way we're not going to feel the pain. There's no way, because of our human nature and because of the way we are. So Genesis 29, starting in verse 30, says this. Then Jacob also went to Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban still another 7 years. When the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Can you imagine being married to someone and being unloved and having them love somebody else rather than you? That is such a tragic thing. That is so terrible to love someone or to want or desire to be loved. So she conceives a child, and she calls him what? Reuben. You know what Reuben means? See a son. She was thinking that now, everywhere he'd be called, it would be rubbing it into Rachel. I've got a son. You don't have one. See? Son. It's like that today. It isn't really changed. There's so many times when young women today will get themselves pregnant by a man in order they think that that'll draw him closer. Now he'll finally love me. Now he'll finally care enough to stay with me so I have a child. But it doesn't work, does it? He goes off somewhere. Now she has a child and she's alone. That's why I come back to this thing about you can't trust your human judgment in these kinds of things. It's the same tragic story over and over. Rejection by the one you love. It's interesting that, by the way, that Leah was the one who bore Judah, who was the one who finally, his tribe gave birth to our Lord and our Savior. And God gave her these gifts, these blessings, because of some of the suffering that she went through. Genesis 37 is another example here in the Bible Genesis 37. It was Joseph. Here his father loved him more than the other children. And so the other children were rejected by the father. So what did the other children do? They rejected Joseph, and they finally wanted to kill him. Genesis 37, 3 through 5. Now Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. And he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed." And he tells them about this dream, and they couldn't speak peaceably to him anymore after this. And in verse 18, now when they saw him far off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill them. And they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer's coming. Come therefore, let's kill him and cast him into a pit. And we'll say some wild beast has devoured him, and we'll see what will become of his dreams." And so here's all this jealousy that is fomented because they didn't measure up like he did, and this back and forth animosity. I think it's the same kind of thing that happened with Cain and Abel. Moses in Exodus 2. In Exodus 2, Moses felt the same rejection. It's a beautiful thing that God did, that he was floated down the stream, and yet he still ended up being able to be nursed by his mother. In verse 11 of Exodus 2. Exodus 2, verse 11. "Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren, and he looked at their burdens, and he saw the Egyptians beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way, and then when he looked the other way, and he saw that no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Then when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, 'Why are you striking your companion?' Then he said, 'Well, who made you a judge or a prince over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?' And so Moses feared and said, 'Surely this thing is known.'" But you understand my point. Here he is trying to stand up for his people, and his people reject him. And now he can't go back to the Egyptians. So now he goes out for 40 years and 10 sheep. And he probably, like Jacob, had to work to get his wife Zipporah. But he was alone with God during this time. And then here he is called back by God and used to free these people from bondage, and they're never satisfied, and they rebel against him, and he's just beyond his wit's end with this. And here Moses then had to stand alone with God. Yes, they feared him because they saw miracle working power, but did they love him? Did they accept him? Were they, very few were loyal to Moses. He was standing alone. And you hear the lament when David writes, that here he had been the hero. He had been the one that conquered the great giant, and he was Israel's hero. And Saul, who he was loyal to, turned against him and drove him away from his own people. Psalm 35. What I'm asking you to do is, I'm asking you to empathize here. I'm asking you to go inside their heads and try to feel what they felt and what they experienced. In verse 11 it says, Psalm 35 and verse 11, "Fierce witnesses rise up. They ask me things that I do not know. They reward me evil for good, to the sorrow of my soul. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth." These people, when they were sick, I was on their side. I was putting sackcloth on, I was fasting, I was praying for them, but now they've turned against me. "I've humbled myself with fasting, and my prayer would return to my own heart, and I paced about as though it were my friend or my brother, and I bowed down heavily as one who mourns for his mother. But in my adversity, they rejoiced, put down again, and again, and again." In Psalm 41, but you begin to get a feeling for what he went through. It's what some of us have gone through, hasn't it? When someone we trusted, someone turns against us, someone we believed in, and someone we loved. 41 and verse 9, you can hear the agony in of this very familiar scripture that is prophetic. Even my own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, with whom I ate bread, he's lifted up his heel against me. Another put down. So, have you ever felt like that? Have you ever had a friend that turned on you? You had someone you were with, someone you trusted? I think most of us have had some of that happen, something like that happen in our life. Felt rejected, felt alone and very hurt. I want to remind you today of this. Jesus Christ felt everything that you did, that he was in all points tested or tempted like we are. Well, my question then is, did he feel rejection? Did he feel it? Of course he felt it, because he was a human being too. In Isaiah 53, for a familiar scripture there, Isaiah 53, Jesus Christ went through so much so that he would know, as our high priest and as our judge, he would know what we feel. He had to feel it, so he would be a faithful high priest. And so was he able to be good looking? Was he attracted? Did women flock to him? Whose believed our report, it says, verse 1, and whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He'll grow up before him as a tender plant and a root out of dry ground. And he has no form or comeliness that we may see him. There's no beauty that we should desire him. He's going to be a root out of dry ground. Have you ever gone and seen some of the plants? I worked in lawn and garden for a while, and I saw some of them didn't get watered. They grew up in dry ground, and they were withered and twisted, and they weren't beautiful and flourishing like the other plants. You ever seen crippled people? People avoid them. They avoid people that are crippled and twisted in life because they aren't good enough, because they might require something from them, because it hurts us to see their pain. Isaiah 53 and verse 3, he's despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely he's borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. And yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions and bruised for our iniquities. And the chastisement of our peace was upon him. And by his stripes we are healed. But we're like sheep, we've gone astray. We've gone astray even after he's done what he's done for us. But you understand, he was despised. He was rejected. The entire crowd that had followed him, the ones that he had fed, the ones that he had healed perhaps even, were now chanting, kill him, kill him. This is the one. I remember when I was a young man, I went to the Watts Festival. And they had had a riot there, and I remember hundreds and hundreds of people coming by me and chanting, you know, white, white, and looking at me with disgust and disdain. It really shook me. I mean, I've always been able to be, you know, sort of had pride in myself when I was a young man, not like today, but I mean, then I did. I thought I could always hold up my head, but when you have hundreds of people that are looking at you like you are despicable and just vile, it was hard to hold my head up. It was very difficult. And so, you know, my point is Jesus understood this. He loved those people. Remember how he went and he looked over Jerusalem and he saw their pain? He saw, he knew, he wanted to heal them. He wanted to take them under his wing. And in another place he looked and he said he knew what they were going to go through. He knew what their future was like. And so he began to feel these emotions well up in him until he became in tears because he loved those people, and they were the same ones that turned on him. And so he wept at that time. He knew, knowing what they would suffer. This is a great truth that I'm going to speak about today, and it's this: he came to his own and his own didn't receive him. He came to his creation, and even the creation wouldn't receive him. And he was rejected, and he was despised and rejected of men. And I will say this today. We think we would never do that. We think that we love God. But I say to this, We do reject him. He has come to us. He's called us. And yet we reject him. We sin, don't we? Do you understand? When we sin, we are turning our back on him. We are rejecting him when we decide that we're going to go ahead and sin. I remember I came to this one night, and it was a time when I had gotten home from work late. I was sitting in my backyard on the back porch, and I remember looking up at the sky because it was so beautiful. It was a full moon, and there were these loose clouds stringing along, and they would pass over the moon and cast shadows, and it was so bright outside, and there was a soft breeze, and the breeze was kind of just tickling my hair, and it was, just waving against my forehead and my skin, and that breeze felt so gentle and so cool. And I thought to myself, you designed all of this for us. You designed it to look this beautiful. And you designed the gentle breeze to feel that way against our skin. You designed all of that for our pleasure. And I just couldn't help praying and thanking God for how beautiful he made life. And he didn't speak to me in words, but he got his message across. Has that ever happened to you where the thought comes in your mind, you know it's not your thought? You know what came into my mind? Then why do you sin if you think that way? If you love me and you think I've done all this for you, why do you sin? It just came straight in my head. I wouldn't be thinking something like that. I went on a whole different track. That came from God, and it's a good question, isn't it? It's a good question to ask. Because he said in so many words in my mind, you reject me. You like this. You like the pleasures. You like the nice things. But you reject me when you turn against me and when you sin. Why do you disobey me? And that's when I saw it. We do reject him when we disobey him and don't keep his commandments. And I want us to understand this point today. You think that God doesn't have feelings like us? We're made in his image. He feels like we feel, but he feels far more intensely than we do because he's on a greater level. He's not unfeeling. You understand? My point is this. Do you ever think about us hurting him when we sin and how much it hurts him when we do something that is against his law and against his commandments? We don't see the pain of the one who really loves us. We reject him by choosing to live our lives by our carnal desires. We reject him by running after false gods, and so we substitute idols of power, success, money, prestige, nice house, nice car, looking good. We reject him when we choose those things over him. And when we do that, and I want to remind us today, we cause him enormous pain, because you felt the pain, haven't you, of rejection. And he feels the pain when we reject him. But we seldom think of the pain the Bible heroes felt. And we seldom think of the pain Jesus Christ goes through, because all we see is our own pain. We see that clear enough. Remember this, we're a spouse to him. And it would be just like a man who saw his wife openly flirting with other men. What do you think that would feel like? We're his wife, and we're going after adulterously false gods of our own making in this world that we live in today. And so I want us to grasp how the people in the Bible have suffered from rejection. I want you to think today of times you have felt rejection, and I want you to realize that there is a connection here, that when we disobey the great God, we reject him. And that it hurts him. And as it says in one place, if we were to fall completely away, it'd be like crucifying him all over again. That's pretty painful. But when we go against his commandments and reject him, we are causing him hurt and pain. Pain and hurt that you and I will never understand or know until we're made like him. So let's understand this truth today, and let's think about it the next time that temptation comes up. Do we really want to reject the one who really loves us.